Title of my talk today is Mistake After Mistake, Let Our Lives Unfold with Compassion. And the first big mistake today was that we have about 20 or 25 of the members of the Zen Center are on retreat down in southeastern Minnesota. And so consequently, and the person who usually rings the bells forgot that he was going out of town too this morning. And so I'm in the position of not only giving the talk, but ringing all the bells. So that's the first mistake that's unfolding this morning. I want to apologize here for any of you who were at a half-day session about a month ago, because some of this talk may be familiar to you. I think I'll start off talking about Shui Feng, who was a 10th century Chinese Zen teacher, Zen master. He had the nickname Black Lacquer Bucket, which was a term, a diminutive that essentially meant dimwit. He spent many years traveling around China, a couple of decades, with teachers, and he would sometimes have to go back again and again and again to the same teacher, be called a dimwit, and then leave. He traveled 9 times to Deng Xiang, who was the founder of the Chinese school, Soto School, and he traveled to another major teacher and stayed with him 4 times. And he eventually became a teacher in his own right, and he eventually had a monastery of 1,500 students, two of which founded one of them founded the Hunman School of Chan, which is one of the 5 schools. And one of his later successors founded the Fayin School of Chan. So for a dimwit, he actually was quite successful in passing on the Dharma. It's sometimes said that he's held in such high regard because failure was his way. Failure was the way. Failure was his path. Dogen Zenji, who is the founder of the Japanese Soto School, which we're a center, would often say that his life was nothing but mistake after mistake after mistake. It almost couldn't be any other way. When you think about it, or when I think about mistakes, I sometimes go to evolution and think about how evolution occurs. It occurs by a mistake. Every genetic morph is a mistake. Our hands are literally mistakes that have come through millennia of evolution. Mistake is really the way. It is the only way. It is what is happening every moment. Sometimes I think about really bad things, like the automobile. And right now it feels to many of us that the automobile and the internal combustion engine and all of the pollution, all of the land destruction, everything that that invention has wrought is a horrible mistake. It's a horrible wrong. And indeed, I think that's a valid perspective on the automobile. On the other hand, in the larger scheme of the evolution of life, we don't know what the automobile is. We don't know what the automobile will eventually bring to the world, to civilization. We have to struggle with it right now because of the pollution it causes and because of the damage it's doing to our environment and to land use. But I think the way it's very easy to go to the point of seeing something like that as a huge mistake and a terrible, terrible invention. But I think if the only, and I'm not suggesting that we don't have to deal with something like the automobile and pollution and global warming. We do. But in the dealing with it, what happens? What takes place? Is there, how do we deal with it? Where do we go with it? What will society look like 100 years from now after we wrangle with the problems that we face? I want to read one quote from Shui Feng. He was known as a teacher who was kind of harsh. He would whack. He was one of those Zen teachers that did a lot of whacking, you know, with sticks. And sometimes the whacking was probably meant to say, geez, you really messed that up. Mistake. Other times it was probably whacking to say, keep it up. Don't stop there. Keep on going. But he was also known, I think, partly because of his long years of being a failure, of not getting it, of struggling with the Dharma. He also showed a very gentle side to some of his students. This is one of the times he didn't whack. Shui Feng told the faltering Chang Qing. So here we have one of his students who is faltering. Told his faltering Chang Qing Hui Leng, later among his Dharma heirs, I'll give you medicine that would revive a dead horse. Can you swallow it? Now, wouldn't you be intimidated? You know, the guy's got his staff right there, and he's... can you swallow it? Chan Qing said he would do whatever Shui Feng recommended. Then don't bother coming to me many times a day, the teacher said. Just make yourself like a burnt stump on the mountainside. If you put your body and mind at rest for 10 years, or maybe 7, or even just 3, you'll surely discover something. I love that quote. The setup is one for some sort of really kind of, you know, Dharma combat, crank it out, get whacked on the side of the head. And all Shui Feng says is go to sit like a burnt stump. Be quiet. Be quiet for 10 years, 7 years, 3 years, 1 year, 1 month, 1 day. Just go and be quiet, and surely you'll learn something. And in essence, he's saying sit zazen. You don't need to go to teachers. You don't need to come every day and talk to me. You don't need to just sit. Just sit. Kind of a very, very gentle teaching. Now, bringing it home a little bit closer, I juggle, not very well. I learned to juggle a few years ago. Well, many years ago. And I haven't juggled since. I haven't juggled for probably 5-10 years. And I thought to myself, there was a learning I had when I was learning to juggle. There was a Zen learning, and I wanted to share it with you. So I went to find my juggling balls, and I've just moved, so I'm unpacking. But when I packed, I realized I hadn't used those balls for 10 years, so I put them in a garage sale. And I no longer have my juggling balls. Now, was that a mistake? You know, it's the kind of thing where you say to yourself, you know, when you're trying to throw something, you think about, should I throw this away? Should I not throw it away? What do you do? Well, in this case, I threw it away. And was it a mistake? I don't know. I hope they're very nice juggling balls, and I hope somebody is having fun with them. So, but I did find 3 hacky sacks. This is a little bit edgy for me, because as I said, I have not juggled for about 10 years. I want to show you the lesson that I learned in when I learned to juggle. Pretty good, huh? Now the lesson in juggling is that dropping a ball is what you have to master when you juggle. It's not keeping them in the air. Because if as you're learning to juggle, if you got bent out of shape every time a ball dropped, you would go crazy. You'd never learn how to do it. You have to really get to the point where dropping a ball is like a raindrop falling on a pond, where it's not a mistake, where it's part of the learning, part of the evolution, part of the process. And it's a little bit contrary to what one would think, that the great art of juggling is based in the very simple act of dropping a ball with equanimity. That's the heart of juggling. Boy, I'm actually impressed with myself on that. And I think that is the point. The point is equanimity amidst mistake after mistake after mistake. Maintaining equanimity, not clutching every time you think you've done something wrong, but simply accepting it and going forward in equanimity. And it's not an intellectual. There's some level of accepting. I mean, you can cognitively walk yourself through dropping a ball and not getting upset. I mean, you can just kind of give yourself feedback. I forget what they call it in therapy, self-talk, you know. Oh, I got upset there. You can do that. And you probably have to do that. And probably while you're sitting zazen, you have to do that. But it's not an intellectual practice of accepting mistakes. It's a living practice. I want to talk now here. Well, before I do it, there are small mistakes and big mistakes, but they're really all the same. There's dropping a hacky sack, and then there's making a mistake that ends in real tragedy. Maybe death. I mean, it's a mistake like the automobile. Could mean the destruction of our planet. There are real mistakes, and I don't want to real mistakes with real consequences, and I don't want to belittle those. But I also want to encourage us all to work with the mistakes in our lives, to use them, as practice, whether they're big or whether they're small, whether they bring financial ruin to you and your family, or whether it means you've got to ring bells and give the talk at the same day. They're all grist for the mill. I want to read a Dharma discourse by Dogen. This is where those of you who were at the half-day session can fall asleep now if you want to. You've heard this before. And this is one of my favorite Dharma discourses by Dogen. And he would give these in his performance art in some ways. He would be on a platform, and all of his monks would be standing, listening to him. And he would give these Dharma discourses, and oftentimes they're very short. And oftentimes there was some dramatic element, like clanking a staff, and sometimes there were long silences. So it's a really kind of a dramatic piece. And I won't do the drama, but I'll read it through once and then go through it more slowly. The millions of billions of transformation bodies of Buddhas abide throughout among staff, carry water and gather firewood to make offerings to Buddhas, as numerous as there are sitting cushions, and on the tip of a whisk, simultaneously all attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. They are all equally named broken wooden ladle Tathagata, worthy of offerings, omniscient, foot of bright practice, well gone one, world liberator, supreme one, tamer of strong persons, teacher of humans and heavenly beings, world honored Buddha. The country of this Buddha is named clump of soil. The kalpa is named fist. The duration of the true Dharma age and semblance Dharma age are both 12 hours, and the Buddha's longevity is that of a dried turd from 3,000 great thousands of worlds. Do you understand? If you state your understanding, you are making mistake after mistake. If you say you do not understand, even the five precepts are not maintained. I like this Dharma discourse both for its content and for its language. And the language that Dogen uses here is pretty flowery. It's pretty over the top. But he's using the language of the sutras. And he's particularly using the language of the Lotus Sutra, and which was very influential to him. I've read the Lotus Sutra, and I don't resonate with it. However, I do resonate with Dogen using the language of the Lotus Sutra, and it's kind of an interesting. I have grown to appreciate the Lotus Sutra more because of the way Dogen uses the Lotus Sutra, and Dogen uses it both in language, but in content. But he's using the sutras generally here. So he says, the millions of billions of transformation bodies of Buddhas abide throughout among staff. So he's starting off with the millions and billions of transformation of Buddhas. All the Buddhas of all time, in all worlds, abide throughout among staff, carry water and gather firewood to make offerings to Buddhas as numerous as there are sitting cushions. And on the tip of a whisk, simultaneously all attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. So what he's doing here is using the language of the sutras, and he's twisting it, as he is wont to do. So he's saying all of the Buddhas in all time abide throughout a monk's staff. The language of the sutras is abide throughout the kalpas. But he takes the kalpas, which are innumerable and inconceivably long periods of time, and he transforms it to a monk's staff. And he says, they abide, carry water and gather firewood to make offerings to Buddhas as numerous as there are sitting cushions. So now the language there is usually, in the sutras, as numerous as the grains of sand in the Ganges. So here he's taking this incredibly, inconceivably large number, and he's bringing it down to a half a dozen cushions in the Zendo. And then the language of this, he says, and on the tip of a whisk, simultaneously all attain unsurpassed, complete, perfect enlightenment. And the language of the sutras is not on the tip of a whisk, but under the Bodhi tree. So he's taking the Bodhi tree, which Buddhists hold up as, you know, it's a place where people make pilgrimages to. It's this tree under which the Buddha attained enlightenment. And he takes it and he makes it into the tip of a whisk. And he's holding a whisk. So what he's doing in all this is he's taking these and the Lotus Sutra is full of these, you know, unimaginable. The language is just over the top. That's why I don't relate to it very well. And he's bringing it right here, right now, in the present moment and in the present number. Now, one knows that, you know, there may be only a dozen sitting cushions here, but how many atoms are in your body? I mean, it's irrelevant in some way. The number is irrelevant. So then he goes on. They are all equally named broken wooden ladle Tathagata. So all of those Buddhas, all of those innumerable Buddhas are named broken wooden ladle Tathagata. Worthy of offerings, omniscient, foot of bright practice, well gone one, world liberator, supreme one, tamer of strong persons, teacher of humans and heavenly beings, world honored Buddha. So what he's done here now is he's taken the 12, is it 12 or 10, epithets, standard epithets for a Buddha, which are worthy of offerings, omniscient, foot of bright practice. And he's added an 11th or 13th. I've got to get my numbers straight. He's added one more. Broken wooden ladle Tathagata. So again, what he has done is he's taken this grand language, this grand concept of Buddha, and he said he's added one broken wooden ladle Tathagata. And think about a wooden ladle in a 13th century Japanese monastery. You use it to wash, you use it to cook, you use it probably to water plants. Whenever water is used in Dogen's time, you're using a wooden ladle. You don't have a faucet to turn on. The water doesn't come from, you know, the Mississippi River through pipes. You're carrying water and you're moving it with ladles, wooden ladles. And I don't know how many of you have used wooden ladles, but they tend to get soaked and dry out, and they crack. They're very, if you will, transient tools because they're used day in and day out. So the Dogen, again, has named a new Buddha, the broken wooden ladle Tathagata. And that new Buddha is probably in your hand 4, 5, 6, 7, a dozen times a day. If you're the cook, probably it's in your hand scores of times in a day. I mentioned when I talked about this at the half-day session that if I ever had the opportunity to name a Zen center, it would be Broken Wooden Ladle Zen Center. So he goes on. The country of this Buddha is named Clump of Soil. I mean, you got a theme here, right? The kalpa, and a kalpa is an inconceivably long period of time, is named Fist. And that's a standard Buddhist teaching method is to hold up your fist or hold up your finger right here, right now. The Kalpa is named Fist. The duration of the True Dharma Age and Semblance Dharma Age are both 12 hours. The Semblance Dharma Age and True Dharma Age are, there's three ages. I think they're supposed to last 500 years. It's kind of the evolution of Buddha from True Buddha, True Dharma to kind of a not quite so true Dharma until the Dharma kind of is no longer around. But I think they're supposed to be about 500 years, and he says they're both 12 hours. And the Buddha's longevity is that of a dried turd from 3,000 great thousands of worlds. That's a classic reference to the Buddha. And do you all understand? That's his question. Do you all understand what I'm saying? And now, and then he says, if you state your understanding, you're making mistake after mistake. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm stating my understanding. And it really is a mistake, because my understanding is not the reality. I mean, it is not reality. I mean, it's my words. It's my understanding. But it's not, it's, if you will, it's the finger pointing to the moon. It's not the moon. And that's what he means when you say, if you state your understanding, you're making mistake after mistake after mistake. Because words can't express, can't truly express the understanding that you have as you sit zazen, as you calm your mind. It's inexpressible. And so that's what he's saying. You know, if you teach, if you talk, you're making a mistake. If you express your understanding, you're making mistake after mistake. Now, of course, he's written thousands and thousands and thousands of words and poems, and you know, I mean, the Chan literature is. That's why every so often, you know, some teacher comes along and burns all the books, because it's like, I mean, it's. And then he says, if you do not understand, even the five precepts are not maintained. And so what he's doing here is he's, you know, we have precepts in Buddhism, and there are a number of precepts, but if you become a member of the community and go through, I forget what we call it, we used to call it Jukai, I think now we call it an initiation, but you sow a rakusu and you take the precepts, you study and take the precepts. What he's saying here, and the precepts are things like, you know, don't kill, don't lie. I mean, you know, kind of good things that human beings ought to do. What he's saying is, you can do all that stuff, but unless you have understanding, you're really just going through the motions. And it's not coming from your heart and soul. And the important thing is for it to come from your heart and soul. I don't think he would say ignore the precepts if you haven't found it yet. The precepts are good. But he's saying that if you don't have the understanding, the precepts, how does he put it? If you say you do not understand, even the five precepts are not maintained. Where are we with that? So mistake after mistake, and Dogen would often say that his life was mistake after mistake, and I think every life is mistake after mistake. I think evolution is mistake after mistake, and the practice is to take those mistakes and not clutch. To approach those mistakes with equanimity and openness and compassion. When you make them and see them, and when others make them and see them. To open your heart to mistakes. To open your heart to the possibility that mistakes offer. I think I'm going to stop there. And if anybody has any questions or comments, now is the time.
So to take an action then is setting in motion some karma in my life, and then I have to deal with whatever that comes up, and then I have to deal with whatever that comes up. Sometimes the understanding of that is, you know, gets in the way to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how does karma fit into what you're talking about?
Well, it certainly does not negate karma. I think there's the story of Baijiang's fox. You don't escape karma. You can't escape karma. I think karma is. And maybe the relationship to what I'm saying is that you take an action, and the action is somehow incomplete or somehow doesn't quite hit it directly, like one's words don't hit reality. And so you take an action. It could be described as a mistake because it isn't perfect. And that imperfection is perfection. And in many ways, it's how you approach and how you are with that action. So you can't escape karma. But you can let karma unfold. You can let actions unfold and karma unfold, and see all of that just as it is. Is not good or bad. Yes.
Actually, turns out to be a follow-on question as we were talking about equanimity, the danger of complacency.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you're answering that question, and I'm not familiar with the concept of karma, so maybe you answered this question earlier. But it seems from your answer that if you keep in mind perfect, then you can have the equanimity. But when you lose sight of the perfect, you're complacent. Is that correct? Is that the safeguard against complacency?
Say that again.
If I keep in mind the perfect, if I'm diligent in my practice sufficiently, then when I use wrong speech, or I don't sit in sasana, or I do some other less than perfect action, as long as I always have the ideal in mind, then I can say, you know, this is a mistake, and I can have equanimity. Whereas I'm complacent, where I just don't have in mind, I don't see that there was a mistake made, there's a model template in my mind of it like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's something there that where I'm at resisting. What I'm resisting is this idea of a model of perfection, when it's really coming back to right here, right now. And that's the perfection. And the so the intent, it takes effort. And so you and what you're talking about is, and it's something that people scratch their heads about all the time, is what is the motivator? What is, and we talk about bodhicitta, to practice Zen, to practice Buddhism, there needs to be effort. And you know, there needs to be, and where does that come from? If you're in fact, the effort is simply to be present. You aren't. So the complacency piece is, you know, in another term for it might be nihilism. And you know, it all doesn't matter, or there's no reason for effort. You know, there's no reason to practice. So, yeah. So I think what you're saying, there's something there, but what I'm kind of not sure about or resisting is the idea that there's some perfection that we're trying to get to, when really we're just trying to stay here.
Well, you did answer my question. I think the right effort is that perfection. I was using, you know, the over-intellectual philosophy, you know, actually shaping the ideal into this big and into this shape. But right effort is, I can say, part of the
thing. Yeah, that I resonate with that better. I'm not resisting that so much.
Yeah, it seems like, just to stay on that, what you said, having an ideal of perfection could be really, really problematic, because so you're aware of your mistakes, but then maybe you're also aware when you're being perfect, which is you're also making mistakes, and you're not considering them mistakes. And so mistake after mistake really is life. Like, you really are not good at what you're doing. You really are screwing up.
Other questions or comments?
I have a comment. It's a tangent about juggling. Circus, like, when you learn circus skills, the first thing you learn is how to fall. I mean, as the safety, but the risk and failure is the whole key. And to clowning, too, the art of the clown is being okay, is getting, having mistakes and then surviving them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.